induction, and it reminds me of Bertrand Russell once said that there are two kinds of logic, deductive and bad. That's something we'll see. This joking remark comes in a little later in the lecture, because there are some people who don't think Russell was joking and take exactly that view, and we'll be discussing them later. Let me give you one more story. Remember when we've sometimes gone over the fallacy of equivocation, where a term can have more than one meaning. You have to be very careful to use the term in the same way in your syllogisms. You can't just shift the meaning. So one thing you have to, sometimes a term can be used in a way you don't expect, and I'd like to give you one story that brings this out. It concerns the case of a German shepherd who couldn't clear customs. You see, the German shepherd insisted on bringing his Irish setter in with him, and the customs officials wanted to quarantine the dog. Now, before I go on to the main subject of the lecture today, induction, I want to apologize. In the last lecture, there were several people who thought it was too hard. I covered a lot of material very fast, and some of it was very difficult material. So I just want to reassure people, if you didn't get everything or you didn't understand everything right away, don't worry about it. But what I'd like you just to take away from that lecture, as sort of the basics I want you to remember, are the modus ponens inference. This is has a form like this. Suppose I say, if my webcam is working properly, then you can see me. My webcam is working properly, therefore you can see me. This has a form. If A, then B. That's the first premise, the hypothetical. Second premise is A, then you conclude, therefore B. So I'd like everybody to remember modus ponens, and then I'd also like you to know modus tollens. This is where you say something, if my webcam is working properly, you can see me. You can't see me, therefore my webcam isn't working properly. So here the structure is, if A, then B, not B, therefore not A. The other thing I'd like you to remember, besides the modus ponens, modus tollens, I remember the fallacies of denying the antecedent, the first one, denying the antecedent, where I say, if my webcam is working, then you can see me. My webcam isn't working, therefore you can't see me. So that would be wrong. I mean, maybe you're in the room with me, so you can see me in some other way. Just denying the antecedent doesn't enable you to deny the consequent as well. And the other fallacy is affirming the consequent. Let's take it. If my webcam is working, then you can see me. You can see me, therefore my webcam is working. That follows the same kind of counterexample, I just gave. Maybe in the room with me, you can see me. So just remember those things, modus ponens, modus tollens, the fallacies of denying the antecedent and affirming the consequent. And then if you can remember that, you don't worry so much about other things in lecture. I'd like, of course, you to learn as much as you can from the other part of the lecture, but just try to, if you know that, I'll at least be satisfied. Now, what we're talking about today what we've been covering in the course so far, we've been discussing deduction. This is how you move from premises to a conclusion. So what we're doing in deduction is showing what are the, we're establishing relationships of consistency. Say, you can't assert certain things and deny other things. You get, if you have certain premises, then this implies a certain conclusion. So this tells us kind of a structure of how various propositions are related. But if we want to get truth out of this, we have to have true premises. Remember, if we have true premises and we reason correctly, then we'll have a true conclusion. But how do we get the true premises? Where do the premises come from? Well, one way we can get it is through analytic judgments. For example, suppose we say all triangles are three-sided figures. That's a definition of a triangle. Analytic judgment doesn't have to be definition, but that's one example. So in an analytic judgment, the subject and the predicate are logically connected. So that's how we know that the premise is true. We can grasp the logical connection between the subject and predicate. Now, it's interesting, in Austrian economics, as Mises developed it, a great deal of the discipline consists of analytic judgments and deductions from them. For example, Mises said, every action uses means to achieve ends. How do we know this? Well, Mises said this is involved in the concept of an action that we're using a means to achieve an end. Say, I want to eat dinner, so for many people, they'd say, well, they want to eat dinner, so the means would be to go cook something. Now, for me, the means would be to go out to eat somewhere because I can't cook anything, but that would be an example. You're using a means to achieve an end. And then another example, Mises give, every an actor always chooses the most highly valued end. Again, this isn't something that he thinks we just find out by looking at various people choosing and seeing if they choose their most highly valued end. He thinks this is a requirement, this is of, it comes from the concept of action, that the actor will always choose his most highly valued end. And if you enroll in my Mises epistemology course, you'll find out why he thinks that. I hope you get the hint there. Now, a lot of things that we know, though, or at least think we know, are not analytic judgments that I've been talking about. So how do we get true premises when we don't have an analytic judgment? And this is the topic of induction. How do we learn from experience? For example, suppose we say we all know that people need to eat in order to live. If you stop eating for more than a certain number of days, you'll die. How do we know that? I mean, it isn't something we can deduce from the concept of human beings or the concept of eating food, but nevertheless, we know that. So how do we know that? How do we come to understand that? Now, this, we might say, well, we just learned this from experience, but this raises a problem. Suppose I say, well, we just know, we experience that people have to eat in order to live. If you try not eating for a while, if you fasted, you'll feel very hungry and weak, so you'll know you have to start eating pretty soon. But there's a problem that experience, if we say we're experiencing something, we're always experiencing experiencing a particular event at a particular time. And we say, well, how do we know that? Well, that is a conceptual truth about experience. That's what experience is. It's particular experiencing something at a given time, some particular event. Say you're now listening to me lecture. That's a particular event that you're experiencing. So how the problem is, how do we get universally true propositions from experience, if experience is always about particular events, particular time? Suppose, for example, we found on a number of occasions that water runs downhill. What justifies our generalization? Water always runs downhill. Or suppose, say, we read in a science book that light travels at approximately 186,000 miles per second. Well, presumably that was established because various scientists had done experiments and they measured the speed of light and found it to be that, to be the speed of light. But suppose you say, well, they just measured the speed of light on those particular occasions. So how do we know that light always travels that at that speed? Why shouldn't we just say, well, they established it just at this particular time, but not at, so why should we say we know that light always travels that at that speed? This is a very important question, as I think you can see, because we need to get we want to get universally true premises that we learn from experience, but it's a problem, how do we get them if we're just experiencing just particular events or things at a given time? Now, unlike deductive logic that we've been studying so far, there isn't a generally accepted answer to this question. In deductive logic, you'll get there won't be people who say, if you have a syllogism, there won't be people who say, it's really all right to have an undistributed middle term. It isn't a matter of controversy. The basic principles of deductive logic are really accepted by everybody, or practically everybody. There isn't really controversy about them. But induction is another matter altogether. Now, the author of our textbook, George Joyce, has a particular answer. I think it's a very interesting one. I'm not sure he's right. I don't think he's wrong. There's certainly a lot to be said for what his point of view. And he has what I'm going to be giving you first is his very distinctive approach to how do we know that we can get truth from particular occasions of experience, how we get these universally true principles. So his solution depends on the fact that a lot of generalizations we make from experience about causes. What does he mean by a cause? He means something like the reason for something. What makes a thing to be what it is? Now, just as an interesting sidelight, some of you have probably heard about a new theory, supposedly new theory of induction that Leonard Peikoff, who's the heir to Ayn Rand, has come up with. He claims he's come up with some revolutionary breakthrough in about the study of induction. And this new theory has been presented in a book by a follower of his, a historian of science named David Harriman, in a book called The Logical Leap. Some of you may have read that or seen it. Now, the funny thing is, if you look at this, read this book, the approach he has is quite similar to what Joyce said. So it's not, what he says is not really revolutionary at all. It's really quite similar to this approach Joyce is giving, which was one that was very popular with some of the scholastic philosophy. So this is another case where I think sometimes the objectivists have claimed to discover things that are actually quite in common use. Now, one thing, you know, this this book that Peikoff had created, tremendous, really unusual controversy came up as a result of it. There was a man who was a very high official in one of the objectivist organizations named McCaskey, who's a historian of science. And he thought that he liked Peikoff's theory of induction, but he thought some of the detailed accounts that Harriman had of Newton's discoveries, in particular, and various other discoveries, were wrong. So he published this criticism. So Peikoff was really very angry about this, that somebody was calling him into question. So just kind of an interesting controversy. If you like gossip, as I do, it's one you might want to look up. So what Joyce, to get back to Joyce, what he says is, sometimes we can recognize a causal relationship immediately. For example, I can grasp immediately that I caused the previous slide to shift to this one. I just clicked on the mouse and that made it shift. And I can grasp that right away, that I made this slide shift. But sometimes it's very difficult to find out what the cause of something is. For example, there are all sorts of things that take place once I click the mouse that go on in the computer that bring about the slide's movement, and you have to know a lot to find out what these are. I mean, we know, say, from studying science, say, we want to know what causes the planets to move around the sun. That's very difficult to find out. It was great discoveries by Kepler and Newton, other people that enable us to know that. But it isn't something we can just grasp right away. But so Joyce makes this distinction here. He says, well, some things we can grasp right away, but sometimes they're very difficult. Sometimes it takes a lot of effort and ingenuity to find out what the cause of something is. Now, Joyce, when he discusses cause, he takes an Aristotelian approach to causality. So I'd like to say a little bit about what his view of causality is, what this Aristotelian view is. This is because it's very different from the way most modern philosophers, contemporary philosophers, think of cause. Now, in the Aristotelian view, there are four types of cause, and you always have these causes working together. There's the final, formal, material, and efficient cause. So if you say, what's the cause of something, you have in the Aristotelian view, there are four answers to this that are all related. Now, the one that's a little, probably the most difficult to grasp, so I'll start with that because it's the one is most different from the way we think of things today, is the final cause. And the final cause of something is its purpose. Now, when we talk about purpose today, we tend to think just of conscious purposes, say, and my purpose now is to give a lecture. I'm giving a lecture. We wouldn't say, well, what's the purpose? We wouldn't if we're non-Aristotelian, we would say, well, what's the purpose of the webcam? In the same way, it wouldn't be that the webcam has some kind of mind that has conscious purposes in the way we do. But in the Aristotelian view, purposes aren't confined to human action. Is everything has a purpose. So this doesn't mean that everything has a mind. That is actually, there is a philosophical view like that. It's or at least something like that. It's called panpsychism. Everything has a mind. But that isn't the Aristotelian view. The view, rather, is that everything has a purpose. For example, you say the purpose of the heart is to pump blood. So in the Aristotelian view, when you have something acting in a certain characteristic way, you say, what is the function of that thing? The fact that it's acting in this certain characteristic way requires some explanation, so the final cause gives you that. In the example that's usually you say, imagine a sculptor who's making a statue. So his idea of what he intends a statue to be is the final cause. Here, the final cause is something that someone consciously has in mind, but again, it doesn't have to be. Now, the formal cause of something is the shape of something. Everything or every object has a certain characteristic shape. What it, say if you're drawing something, what the outlines of things would be, its form, what sort of is holding in all the matter, that's the form. And Joyce gives the example, the shape of the statue, what the statue really looks like. And related to this goes with it, the material cause is what something is made of. For example, if you have a marble statue, then the material cause is the marble that makes up the statue. That's pretty straightforward. So again, the formal cause, the statue would be the shape of the statue, and the material cause is what it's made of. Now, the formal and material causes are called intrinsic causes because they don't make any reference to anything outside the thing whose causes they are. Say we have, imagine a statue. You think of any statue we want, like Rodin's The Thinker. We just look at the statue, we don't have any reference to, we look at the form of it, you see a man with his holding his head, so that's the form, and that doesn't make any reference to anything outside that form. It doesn't make reference to Rodin or any particular person that may have been modeled on. And similarly, what the statue is made of doesn't refer outward to anything else. It's just that's what they're just present in the particular object you're looking at or you're concerned with. Now, the last cause that we have, the one we haven't mentioned yet, remember we mentioned a final formal material, the one left is the efficient cause. Now this is the closest to the modern conception of a cause. Say if we talk now, well, what is, say if I say, nowadays, suppose I say, what is the cause of a particular fire? Well, I struck a match, I started the fire. Say I started a forest fire by throwing the match into the forest. You'll forgive me for mentioning at this point one of my favorite slogans, which is forest fires prevent bears. I'm waiting for the laughter there. So the efficient cause, I say, is the closest to the modern conception of cause, but it isn't exactly the same. In the example of changing the slides, where I said I caused the change, I'm the efficient cause of the slide moving to the next slide, I would be the efficient cause because I brought about this change. So it wouldn't be, in the scholastic view, it wouldn't be the various events that happen when I click the mouse that bring about, that follow this and then the slide changes, that are the efficient cause. The efficient cause in Oh, good, I'm back. I guess somebody didn't want me to explain the difference between the scholastic and modern view. So in this modern view, you have an event that results in another event. So a cause is really a change of some kind. In the scholastic view, the efficient cause is a substance that's doing something or acting. So the final and efficient causes are called extrinsic causes because they refer to what's outside the object. Remember, material and formal are intrinsic causes because they are just what's in the object you're concerned with. Again, in the statue, the shape of the statue, and the material it's made of don't make any reference outward. But the final and efficient causes are quite different. Say the final cause is what the sculptor has in mind, what he wants the statue to be. It's very related to the formal causes. What his wanting this, he's made the statue so it'll have this particular form. That's the final cause of the statue. And then the efficient cause is the sculpture himself, of course. So the final cause and the efficient cause do make reference to outside the actual statue because they refer to something in the sculpture, what the sculptor has in mind is what he wants the statue to be. And similarly, say if you're not concerned with something that's created by a mind, say if you say the heart, the purpose of the heart, again, circulating blood, that is something outside of the actual entity. I mean, William Harvey had to discover that in the 17th century. It isn't something you could just look at and see right in the heart that that's what the function of the heart is. So the function, the final cause is outside the thing, the object. It's, of course, same for the efficient cause. It's something, a substance that's acting on the object to bring about something or to cause something. Now, this is all very well. We talked about, we now know what Joyce means by a cause. We now know it means, it's referring to any one of these four causes. And he also has other things that I won't go into detail, like determining cause and difference between cause and condition. But he's given, as usual, kind of a very elaborate terminology on classification of cause. But how does this help us solve a problem of induction? Well, we know what we're looking for. We can want to know the cause of something that can be any one of the four causes, but how is this going to help us come up with these universal causal generalizations? And here we get to what the heart of Joyce's question. I see some question. Now, Michael says efficient causes of substance. Yes, that's right. Say, we would say in the example you give, say someone is hitting a baseball, it would be in the Aristotelian view, the cause of the baseball's movement would be the hitter, not his hitting the baseball. So, the efficient cause, that's not, I mean, it would, you can certainly answer, Danny's right, you could certainly answer this, but this would be the modern usage of the term efficient cause. In the scholastic usage, it's a substance. The actions are just sort of flowing from the substance, but they're not the efficient cause, really. So it's a bit of an unusual usage. That's why I was mentioning that. A substance is something that can exist by itself. Say, we wouldn't have actions floating in the air just by themselves, like the grin of the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland that was still there when the cat disappeared. It's now Danny says, isn't the house builder the efficient cause of the house? Yes, exactly. It's the house builder who's the cause of the house, not his building the house, you see. That's the whole point. That's a very good, I'm glad you bring that up. How does Joyce use this apparatus of the four causes to help solve the problem of getting these universal generalizations? What he says is, when you arrive at a cause of something, you can abstract from particular details the instance you're considering. Now, here in the example where I'm going on next, what I have on the slide isn't strictly correct. I'm giving more of a modern usage there. I say here I can abstract from saying the clicking mouse this time caused the slide to move. I can say, because I just did this because it's more convenient to make the point here, but I should strictly say, if you take this to me, I made the slide to move because I'm the substance, but I'm just doing this for convenience. So suppose I say, if I click on the mouse, this causes slide to move. Well, it isn't when I say that. There isn't anything just specific to a particular time or place that makes this true. I can abstract away from that. I could just say something like clicking the mouse in certain circumstances will cause a slide to move. So I'm not making any reference to a particular occasion. But does that solve the problem? So as I say, well, I've got a causal statement that isn't restricted to a particular occasion, but how does that solve the problem of induction? How do you know that this abstract causal statement will always apply? Suppose, again, you take a statement in science. If you throw a ball in the air, gravity will cause it to come down. Well, that isn't making any reference to a particular ball or on a particular occasion. It's a general statement. But how do you know it's always true? What justifies us in this universal generalization? So Joyce appeals to what he calls the principle of the uniformity of nature. This is one of the key points in the chapter. Again, I hope I don't, as I didn't last lecture, bring in a lot of too many points for you, but this is one I definitely like you to remember. This principle called the uniformity of nature, because it's one of the keys you need to grasp if you want to understand what Joyce's account of induction involves. So I think the phrase was actually coined by the 18th century philosopher, theologian, economist, Richard Whately, Bishop Whately, I think was the first one to use that particular phrase, but the idea is much older than that. So what the principle of a uniformity of nature is, that the same cause will, under the same circumstances, produce the same effect. So this is, according to Joyce, what the, how we get the, how we know that these causal relationships that we can grasp really apply universally. Now let's see if Danny has something interesting. Yes, that's interesting that Mises mentions this, also has a similar view, but he has a somewhat different justification for it from Joyce's. Now, Joyce said, this is all very well, we say same cause, same effect. That's sort of a simple way to understand uniformity of nature. But how do we know that's true? I mean, isn't this just, you could say, well, isn't this just solving the problem of induction by just postulate, just, well, I say, well, how does it follow from the fact that we're seeing, we're grasping some particular event, some particular causal event that we see, say, my striking a match caused the fire to start. What justifies us in saying striking a match under similar circumstances will always cause a fire to start? Well, we say, well, we're appealing to uniformity of nature, but isn't that just saying that the reason we're justified in concluding universally just is that we're justified in concluding universally? Isn't this just solving the problem by declaring it solved? And Joyce says, no, that's not right. He says it's a metaphysical principle. It's one that we discover to be true when we're studying metaphysics, that applies to the physical world. And whether he's right about this is a very interesting question. It's not one I really am altogether sure about. It's not what most philosophers now wouldn't think that he's right, but I think there's a good deal to be said for it. But it's not really clear. If he has a chapter on the uniformity of nature you can read if you like. It's after the one on induction. And it's not really clear that he has any real proof of this. He just seems to be saying, look, if you think about this, you'll see that it's true. I mean, maybe you will, but you just have to, people have, many modern philosophers don't agree with him on this, but I think there is something, a lot to be said for what he said. I'm sorry I can't give you any more definite resolution of the matter other than to say it's one of the points of view you should be aware of and consider. Now, he makes here kind of a subtle distinction, I think is a good one, interesting one. He says this wouldn't be the right way to reason. This would be wrong to reason. Suppose you say you have, in any induction you want to make, you would start with the nature is uniform as the major premise. And suppose we say nature is uniform, and we say on various occasions my clicking the mouse causes a slide to move, and then we conclude clicking the mouse in the right circumstances will always cause a slide to move. Now, we have a couple we have a couple of questions. Let me just look at the questions here. Yes, Anish says, aren't we begging the question? Yes, that's the objection, but Joyce claims apparently that we can directly grasp that this principle is true, and whether he's right or not is just what's at issue. Michael says uniformity of nature varied from Aristotle's always or mostly. Well, I think what Aristotle was concerned with when he saw always and mostly, that sometimes we can say that things operate according to a certain tendency. So we'll say the heart usually will always or mostly beat at a certain rate per minute within a certain range, but it might not on occasion, it might deviate from that range here. But here uniformity is being used more strictly, that if you specify the circumstances exactly enough, then the claim is if you have the same cause, you will have the same effect. And then we have a question here. Wouldn't denying this principle lead to absurd results? Well, I mean, if you denied it, then we wouldn't have a justification. Then we'd say induction to generalization isn't established, but whether that's absurd or not, I suppose, could be argued. I mean, there's certainly philosophers today who don't think it's so absurd to deny that. I mean, they could also say, well, they could think that it's true, it happens to be true that the same cause, same effect, but it's not a metaphysical principle, it's just maybe something that happens to be the case. So that might be another thing they might respond there. But so getting back to what this mistake is, so when Joyce is thinking, suppose somebody reasons on various occasions, nature is uniform on various occasions, my clicking mouse causes a slight move. So clicking the mouse in the right circumstance will always cause a slight move. So Joyce says this is incorrect, not that there's a formal fallacy in this syllogism, but he says, once I say that clicking the mouse causes the slide to move, again, that isn't strictly Aristotelian way to put it, but never mind that. I mean, Aristotle isn't here to come and mark me off. I've already appealed to uniformity. That is, I've claimed that it's in the nature of clicking the mouse in the appropriate circumstances, as a result, the slide will move. So I'm already relying on uniformity, so I don't need to bring it in as the major premise of the syllogism. So what Joyce is saying, we can sometimes, when we grasp a causal relationship, we're already grasping that it applies universally, and it's because of this principle of uniformity of nature, but it isn't that uniformity of nature is a separate principle. Because if you don't get what this means, here's an analogy might bring it out. Remember, when we had in one of the earlier lectures, I mentioned that there's this dictum, the omni, what applies to the whole of something applies to all the parts. It's at the basis of syllogistic reasoning. But even though that principle is at the basis, it doesn't mean it's a premise in every syllogism. It just explains why the syllogism is true. So similarly here, it's when I say, according to Joyce at any rate, when I say there's a causal relationship, uniformity is involved, but I'm not reasoning with the uniformity of nature as a premise in a syllogism. It's perhaps a minor point, but I think it's still an interesting one to note. Now, before I get into the way some modern philosophers disagree with Joyce, now here's a question from Sandra. Doesn't love... Sandras doesn't law of entropy make it not true that nature's universe? Well, you see, this isn't saying that nature doesn't, in the sense of things that we're looking at, the world out there doesn't change. It's just saying that similar cause, the same cause will have the same effect. So the way we know that, and if in this case, if the law of entropy is true, then it's always true in the appropriate circumstances. It isn't saying anything about this causal principle. It isn't saying anything about what nature doesn't change, or change takes place in a very gradual, uniform way, as we have the doctrine uniformitarianism in geology. This is completely different. This is a matter of how causes bring what the causes in the same circumstance always bring about the same effect. Yes, and Danny points out Mises quite rightly. I think Mises considered that we have to have uniform. This is again a different sense. Really involve both senses of uniformity, same causes, same effects, and we'd also want for action to take place. We want these causes and effects to be operating in a way that we could see what was going on. It would have certain constancy, but remember that's a different. That there are two different meanings of uniformity there. One is same cause, same effect, and then the other would be changes that they take place don't take place in such a manner that we're unable to grasp them. They're different. So again, I want to mention now something else Joyce talks about, which is different from the kind of induction we've mentioned, just been talking about for this most of this lecture, which is ordinary induction. Is we're trying to say, how do we move from saying that something has happened in particular instances, we've measured the speed of light and found 186,000 miles per second on these occasions, how do we know that's universally true? Now, this other type of induction is called inductive syllogism. This is different from ordinary induction. In an inductive syllogism, is if something applies to all the logical parts of a whole, it's true of the whole. Sometimes you find this in geometry. For example, suppose you say you separate triangles into all various logically possible classes. You say all triangles have to fall in one of these classes. And then you prove that for each of these classes, something is the same thing is true of each class, and you can say the same thing is true for all triangles. So now that might not be such a clear example. Let me give you, remember in the last lecture, we talked a bit about dilemmas. Now, suppose you give a dilemma where you present an opponent with undesirable alternatives. Suppose you say, well, to an opponent, there's various things that might happen, and you list them and say, it has to be that one of the following alternatives will take place, say 1, 2, or 3. These are going to take place. So every one of those alternatives will have a bad consequence for you. You can conclude from that whatever happens will have a bad consequence for you, because you said each alternative will have a bad consequence for you, and those are all the alternatives, so you know that whatever happens will have a bad consequence for you. So this, if we have an inductive syllogism, it doesn't establish a connection between the nature of the whole subject and the property attributed to it, because the property might apply to each of the parts in different ways. For example, in the case I gave you with the dilemma, you say, well, one of the alternatives could have this kind of bad consequence for you. The next alternative will have another kind of bad consequence for you. The next alternative we'll have yet another one. We say these are all the consequences, so these are all the alternatives, so we know something bad's going to happen to you. But it's the reason we know something bad's going to happen to you is a different one in each case. So you don't necessarily have an inductive syllogism, the same kind of typological connection. It's called the typological connection between the nature of the whole and the property attributed to it. Say, in the case I gave, the bad consequence would come about not because just because something's going to happen to you. It wouldn't get from the concept of something going to happen. It wouldn't be good for you. It would be because it's a generalization from these various alternatives, each one of which is bad, and those are all the alternatives. Now, there's another kind of induction, which is, this is different from we've talked about causal induction, getting started from causal relationships in the inductive syllogism. Now, there's another kind, which is a really induction by enumeration. You just consider the instances in a certain whole that possess a certain property, so then you can conclude that every instance has the property. So you notice how the difference from the inductive syllogism, that's about the logical parts of a whole, which are kind of subtypes of a whole, like different kinds of triangles, not instances. Here you're just concerned with particular instances. So you say, all swans are white. That would be one you, if you said that, it wouldn't be correct, but you'd be getting it by just listing various ones. And, well, this one is white, this one is white, this one is white, so on. So that's an example of induction by enumeration. Now, if you go through every instance, if you enumerate every instance, the induction is called a perfect induction, and it's valid. Now, to give an example I used in an earlier lecture, supposing I ask each student in this class, are you interested in logic? And everyone says yes. Well, I suppose you better say yes if you want to pass the course. So then I can I see Danny has mentioned Hume. I'm going to be dealing with Hume shortly. I can conclude that everyone in the class is interested in logic simply because I've asked this one, this one, this one, and we've gotten everybody in the class. Now, but suppose I just generalize from a few instances, then the induction is imperfect and isn't worth much. Suppose, say, I ask various people, do you like Austrian economics? Well, most of my friends do like Austrian economics, so suppose I concluded everybody likes Austrian economics, but that wouldn't be correct because I just asked a few people. Now, Eric asked, would it be fair to say induction by... No, I don't think that's right. I mean, you could think of various ideas. You say, all the ideas I'm having at a certain moment, if you could, and then ask, say, all the ideas I'm having at a certain moment are of such and such a kind. I don't think you'd have to apply this to only to sensory objects, although probably most induction by enumeration would be that. I mean, I suppose there are certain problems, your question is a very good one, in how you quantify abstract objects. So maybe that is a good question, but I mean, in principle, I don't think you would have to do it that way. I mean, restricted to sense reality. But if you thought it was a problem about quantifying non-sensory objects, then you would be right. Now, as I mentioned, the scholastic account, which Joyce has given, wouldn't be accepted by most modern philosophers who work on induction. And they've been influenced by a famous argument that from David Hume, the great 18th century Scottish philosopher. And he denied that the principle of uniformity of nature could be established by reason. So he said, we can't know by reason that this principle of uniformity of nature, same cause, same effect, is correct. And he said, well, he didn't say we shouldn't use induction, except, well, this is a habit we have. He didn't think there's anything wrong with that, but he said we could, that's the way human beings are, but he thought this isn't something we can establish by reason. And his argument for it is a very influential one, it's a very interesting one. And he said, well, suppose we wanted to establish the principle of uniformity. How would we do it? How would we be able to do it? Well, he said we could either do it by reasoning or we could get it from experience. Those seem to be the only sources of how we know things. We can get things by learning them from experience or by reasoning about them. So it has to be one of these two. But then he said it isn't contradictory to deny uniformity. Suppose somebody said same cause but not same effect. It wouldn't be a contradiction. Suppose what would be the contradiction in this? It isn't as if we're denying the law of identity. Remember, I mentioned in one of the lecture on the laws of thought, the objectivists think that law of causality follows from the law of identity, but as I mentioned before, I'm not going to go into details now. I don't think that's a very plausible view. So if you can say, well, it isn't contradictory to deny uniformity, so we can't say that the principle is a truth of reason, but suppose we say experience supports the principle because the same cause has been observed to have the same effects in the past, how does Oh, good. I'm back now. I hope I'm frozen. Okay. Yeah, I don't know why the thing does that. Maybe it's to try to show that things aren't. If uniformity of nature is operating, it's not in a way that produces a uninterrupted image of the camera. Okay, suppose I say, well, water's been observed so many times to flow downhill, so then I conclude from experience it will flow downhill. But then Hume said, well, if I reason that way, I'm assuming uniformity of nature, so I'm kind of begging the question. If I say experience supports that only if the past experience it gives us good grounds to expect future experience to have the same characteristics, but that's just what the question at issue is. So that's been a tremendously influential argument. And remember, Joyce said, no, this is wrong. We've just grasped that this principle of uniformity, same cause, same effect, is correct. And Hume said, no, we don't grasp this. So we have this basic difference of opinion. Now, what are we going to do? Suppose you think Hume was right. I don't say that he was at all. I mean, I think, as I say, there's a great deal to be said for what Joyce said. But suppose you say that Hume was right. As I say, Hume didn't want to get rid of induction, but the great 20th century philosopher Karl Popper had a more radical approach. He said, well, what we can do, we can accept Hume's argument, say Hume has shown there's no basis for induction, but we don't need induction, especially in science. We don't need to say that from the fact that a number of instances of causal relation observed, we're justifying inferring a causal law. What we do instead is we come up with a hypothesis that can be falsified. We don't need anything more than this. Suppose, say, I come up with the hypothesis all swans are white. Then I go to Australia and I see there's a black swan. That was where black swans were discovered. So then my hypothesis, all swans are white, has been falsified. So according to him, see, I'm not bringing in induction at all. I'm not going from any statement about what happens in a few instances, what happens in all instances. I just come up with a hypothesis and then say it's been falsified. Now, Bill asked, how do we know the same hypothesis will be falsified in the future? Well, according to Popper, we don't know. Suppose you once it's falsified, then you know that the universal hypothesis is always false. You could come up with a new hypothesis from henceforward, all swans will be white, and then see if that's falsified. But you don't know whether a hypothesis will be falsified in the future. You just keep testing it to see whether it would be. So this is, as you see, it's kind of a skeptical view. We can say that a theory hasn't yet been falsified, but this doesn't give any grounds at all to continue that it will continue to be true in future. So he says, well, what we're doing so far, we've got theories that so far survived attempts to falsify them, but that doesn't give us any grounds to think that they'll continue to be true in future. So this is kind of a very skeptical view. Say, we don't know, say, that stepping in front of a speeding car will have bad consequences for you if you do it. We can formulate a hypothesis that it will and then test it out, but we don't know this. Now, Anisha, did Popper live his life? Did he actually believe this? Probably not, but he wouldn't think that's an objection to what he's saying. He says I was discussing this once with my friend Jeremy Shermer, who was Popper's research assistant for many years, and he said, well, what Popper's concerned with is just a sense of knowledge that's used in science. So he said, well, we might have some kind of common sense views that are different, but what we're really concerned with is the sense of knowledge that's used in science. And I'd be inclined to say there's a danger there of just inventing some kind of special sense for knowledge that's not related, different from our ordinary language sense of a term. It's not clear why we should be concerned with knowledge in Popper's sense, although he thinks this is the way to get around the Humean problem. Now, I'll conclude. I usually give examples of fallacy. So we had, soon in the class, Christopher Weldy said in this case, which is kind of an interesting one, I thought, someone wrote, do you realize that anything which applies to government also applies to God? That the government is the one earthly entity that closest resembles God. Well, I guess the person who said this isn't the most literate person. If obeying to government, if blind faith and obedience in the government is wrong, same thing goes for God. And Christopher wants to know, is this an example of begging the question? Well, What's wrong with that? I don't think it's strictly begging the question where you're arguing for a conclusion on the basis of a saying, of a premise that states that very conclusion. So it, the argument isn't saying from not obeying the state is like not obeying God, and then concluding not obeying the state is not obeying God. But it's a related fallacy. It's that you're assuming a very controversial premise that the state is like God, that probably only those who already reject disobedience are likely to accept. So you see, what you're doing in this argument is that you're really giving your, it's the argument that isn't really very useful in controversy, because no one who would accept the premise would have rejected your conclusion in the first place. It's supposed you said something like suppose you want to argue against Austrian economics, you say something like, since Keynes is always right, and Keynes criticized Austrian economics at various points, Austrian economics is wrong. Well, the problem with that argument, if you're trying to use that to show someone who's interested and sympathetic to Austrian economics that something's wrong with it, that a person who likes Austrian economics wouldn't accept the premise that Keynes is always right. So you see, you have to be careful not to assume a controversial premise that somebody, that you know, your opponent would be unlikely to accept. Okay, and then the last thing, someone asked whether the argument we just discovered has an undistributed middle term. I don't think so. If somebody thought it did, I'd like to know what it is. Now, Anish says hasn't shown in what way. Yes, that's an interesting point. I'd have to think about that one. Oh, this is on this new argument. Let me look at this. It says, you see the word obedience appear a lot in the Bible, and you see Christians use the word obedience a lot. The last time a charismatic person used the word obey and obedience as often as the Christians do, the Second World War erupted. I say let's get rid of both the government, Christianity, and all other religions for what all I care. Well, he's kind of something, a bit of a nihilist. So as Michael Rowell suggests, this is committing a post hoc, ergo propter hoc fallacy, because it says the last time a characteristic person used the word obey and obedience as often Christians do, the Second World War erupted. And just because the war came after use of obedience doesn't follow using this word caused the war. Now, Peter said, doesn't this assume that Christians are charismatic? I think that might be an interesting objection. So it's only, I don't think it would be, because he's just saying that it's a charismatic person's using obedience, Second War. So you're saying maybe if Christians used obedience and they weren't charismatic, then maybe it wouldn't cause a war. So maybe he's got the wrong causal hypothesis. Yes, that's interesting. Yes, that could well be. But I mean, of course, you'd want to know just because the most basic thing to note here is just that he's assuming that because one came after the other, one caused the other. But your point is interesting also. Well, I guess that ends the lecture. So in the time we have left, we'll have questions, objections, needs a Venn diagram. Yeah, yes, well, as long as that's not circular reasoning. Now, how can it be true? Bill asked, is pauper viewing nature assumes pauper assuming nature doesn't change? No, he's not assuming the nature of the universe won't change. He's just saying, so this hypothesis is either falsified or not. And then if you then say you want to retain the hypothesis, he's not making any assumptions that your hypothesis has been shown to be true. It's just it hasn't yet been falsified. Fernando wants to know what's a major fallacy. Well, I don't think it's a formal fallacy. It's just that it's an extremely skeptical view, and I think people should, you'd want to avoid it unless you really felt you had to favor it. It's funny with the Popperians, most philosophers, if they will try to avoid skepticism, but the Popperians seem very willingly to embrace it, although they don't call it skepticism. They say, well, nobody really knows anything. All we have are conjectures, and we don't know that our conjectures are true or have any grounds for thinking they'll apply in the future. So they're quite willing to accept that. Now, Mike says, did I discuss David Harriman's book? I mentioned it. I said that Peikoff's theory of induction is claimed to be very original, but it's very similar to the one that Joyce gives. Let's see now. Anish says, surgeons use knives, some murderers use knives, therefore let's get rid of surgeons. Yes, that's an interesting, it does seem to be certainly something's wrong that I'm not quite clear that it's exactly the same structure as the previous argument that's clearly related to it. Now, Danny wants me to comment on Thomas Kuhn's objection. Let me see. What Kuhn was saying is a very interesting point. He said, well, scientific theories don't really follow Popper's model. Remember, what Popper says is once you have a falsification of the theory, that shows the theory, that theory hypothesis has to be abandoned. Kuhn says, well, scientists don't actually do that. And I think that's a very good point. Theories will be retained even though they have certain problems, apparent falsifications, simply because they're better than the alternatives, or scientists can think that they'll be able to resolve these anomalies later. Now, Popper's response to Kuhn, there was a volume published that had Kuhn and Popper had discussions with each other, and various other philosophers of science chimed in. I remember it came out with Cambridge University Press. It was but Popper says, well, he said to Kuhn, well, all right, even if scientists do that, they're wrong. He said, what I'm trying to do as a philosopher of science is say, this is what science ought to be. I'm not trying to describe scientific practice. I'm a philosopher trying to give a model for science. And Kuhn was different. He said, no, we have to go by what actually scientists do. Let me see. Now, what happens if you ask a Popperian whether the principle of the uniformity of nature inductive syllogism is correct? Well, I think they would have to say inductive syllogism is correct because that's actually a matter of deductive logic, even though it's called inductive syllogism, they accept induction. So I think they could say you could conjecture the principle of uniformity. You could have that as a conjecture, but it wouldn't be something that you could establish. Now, Bill asked Michael Polanyi says all forms of science require a kind of human instinctual belief. Yes, I think he thought that was his view. I mean, that people, he thought that not everything we believe can be established explicitly, Pliny spoke of tacit knowledge, say, that things we wouldn't be able to specify exactly how we know everything that we do. No, we wouldn't be able to state this explicitly. This is a big point Hayek also. Eric mentions, couldn't science be taken as a practical enterprise? This is a view called instrumentalism, sort of theory. As long as theory works, we should accept it. That wasn't the view Popper held. I mean, there are people who hold that view, but I mean, on the other hand, one wants to find out what the truth is. I remember Sidney Morgan-Besser had a comment on, he said something like, pragmatism is true, but it doesn't work. E.T., I'm sorry if you kept asking, that must mean I wrongly ignored your question. Since the principle of uniformity applies to physical world and praxeology applies to human action, do we need to assume principle of uniformity in praxeology? Well, I think we would, to the extent that we'd be thinking, you remember when Mises talks about various recipes that we have, how we act in characteristic ways to produce certain things, we'd be assuming that if we know how to use means to achieve ends. If we don't, then we're not going to be able to act in a very coherent way. Anish says, if I read, what do I think of Alistair MacInnes' book? Well, I remember, remember that book came out in 1981. I think there's some problems with that book. You see, now what he thinks there's been a breakdown in moral language because we have conflicting views of morality. Say, one person will be arguing from one theory of morality, somebody else from a different theory. And he thinks that because there's been a breakdown, that we can't really understand certain moral principles. Certain truths, say that they have a certain middle age. But it's not clear to me why, say, suppose we imagine everyone except holding a certain view, were all died off. Or you can imagine everybody being converted to the same view today. I don't think that would show that view was established. It would rescue us from skepticism. It would just show everybody held that view. Let's see, these a priori, the a priori assumptions wouldn't be inductive assumptions. They'd be ones that we would know just from, they'd be conceptual matter, so we wouldn't be the same, wouldn't have the same problems that we had in asking how to justify induction. Now, let's see, Danny said, is Hume saying that causal induction is a category of action? I think he would be saying that it's a category that we use in action. It wouldn't be confined to action, since it would be a determination of mind. It would involve how we're thinking about things as well as how we're acting. The assumption wouldn't be reached through induction. They'd be reached through our grasp of concepts and seeing what's involved with it. Remember, in the first couple slides, I was talking about analytical judgments. It would be that kind of judgment. Mises does say at one point, how do we know praxeology applies to other people? He just says, I think he said that in conversation with Kirzner, you will find that it works, but I don't think, it doesn't mean he thought that the whole structure was just based on its practical use. That would be going too far. No, the laws of kinesiology aren't derived from the physical world. So E.T. wants to know why we need principle uniformity. Because we're doing things, we're acting on the physical world, and if we don't have principle uniformity, then it's going to very put a big dent in how we're able to act. So we don't strictly need it, I suppose, in, you could have praxeology, I suppose, a very truncated praxeology without it, but we'd be in kind of big trouble. We're sociology involves physical world in the sense that human beings are physical entities, certainly partly physical entities, but it doesn't follow that everything that's true about them is derived through induction. That would be what praxeology is questioning. Praxeology said there's some a priori knowledge that we have also. Justin wants to know, did I ever meet Leonard Peacock? No, I'm sure he wouldn't like me because of the rather less than enthusiastic reviews I've done of his books. Now, Sandra said, isn't induction what's used to predict weather? I think that's right. I mean, you would go on the basis of certain data that's been collected plus various mathematical formulas. Michael says one can induce ulcers in baboons most by shocking them unpredictably. It sounds plausible. It sounds like you know more about producing ulcers in baboons than I do. Danny says, what was Kant's position on this? Kant thought that we had causality was an a priori category of the mind. He said if we denied causality, by which he would include some principle of uniformity in nature, he said we wouldn't be able to grasp the world at all. So it isn't, according to Kant, it isn't that we perceive the world and then say, well, am I justified in concluding from just a few instances of some kind of relationship to universal generalization? He said if we didn't have this category of causality, we wouldn't be able to grasp the world at all. We wouldn't have coherent experience. Now, we surely can't let go of something. So he said, wouldn't the a priori assumption human acts come from inducing myself in nature? No, to apply, what it isn't that I, when I, according to Mises, it isn't that when I'm talking about action, I'm talking about my action and then asking the question, do the conclusions that apply to me apply to everybody else? I'm just, according to Mises, I'm talking about the concept of action, and then that applies to any instance of action, regardless of whether it's my action or anybody else's. So Mises is not, and I say this in my lectures a lot, but he's not a Cartesian skeptic. He's not saying, I start off with just thinking about myself and then say, how do I know various things about the world? He's saying we have certain concepts and we're trying to reason about them. Now let's see, Anish thinks there's a problem with the argument by Hume. Usefulness implicitly assumes uniformity of nature. But you see, the question there, I think, would be, what is not that Hume is questioning whether nature operates in a uniform way. He isn't saying maybe it doesn't, but he's thinking, can we know this? And he said, no, it's just a matter of habit. So when he says it's useful for us to extend our knowledge, he isn't claiming to have established that that's true. He just thinks that's a habit that we have. Well, everyone's going to want to read the epistemology class. Well, what you basically want to be reading is, they say, the first 140 pages or so of Human Action, and then also Theory and History, Epistemological Problems of Economics, and Ultimate Foundation of Economic Science. So we're basically studying some of the key works of Mises. If we can get some students for the class, I think there aren't too many so far, but I hope to see more of you in the class. Okay, we have a few minutes left. E.T. can't get... E.T. says... you're thinking, you get laws of human action by thinking about human action, but how, what the extent of uniformity is something, that's how you're, what you're doing in the world, that isn't something, so the limits of what you can do in the world aren't something that we just know by thinking about them. So we're not assuming, when we're talking about concept of human action, we're not assuming any inductive principle. We're just starting from nature of human action. But then if we want to know what things we can do in the world, that does bring in inductive knowledge. We want to know to what extent will doing certain things have the same results, how firmly established is that belief. Well, Savannah, thank you. I'm glad you liked my course. Thank you. It's very nice having you in the, we've had some very good students here. I hope she heard that. Now, let's see, Mike says, continue, what area of book would you recommend? Well, I mean, to lay a foundation, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think am I still there? Hello? Am I still there? Oh, good. I'm glad you like the course. Danny says, what's the difference between analytic judgment and deduction? Well, an analytic judgment is a single proposition. It says there's a conceptual relation between the subject and predicate, like all men are mortal. Say, mortality is, if that's analytic, it's supposed to be conceptually related to men. There's something in the nature of man that makes it true that men are mortal. And deduction has to have more than one proposition. Say, all men are mortal, Socrates is man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Am I back now? Can you still hear me? Oh, good, good. Okay, my recommendation for my, I said people should read Human Action. Now, Michael wants to know why more than not needing to eat. Well, I wasn't actually, I'm just using that as an example. I mean, I mean, it didn't seem to me that we could just deduce from the concept of man that man needed to eat. I mean, you could deny that, I suppose. I think that's something just we know from studying physiology. I mean, somebody could deny that about being mortal as well, but that's, you know, I mean, I'm just basically using that as an example. I wasn't intending to make any claim about a priori physiology or a priori anthropology. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, so I'd like to thank all of you for coming to my course. You've been excellent students, and thanks so much for being in the course. And I hope that we'll see you in my next course in epistemology. Thanks very much, everybody. Thank you. Bye, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'm going to stop recording now.